This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You're listening to the Reversing Climate Change podcast by the team at NORI, the Carbon Removal Marketplace. This is a show about the innovators and entrepreneurs developing solutions to climate change.
Hello and welcome to the Reversing Climate Change podcast with NORI. I'm Ross Kenny. I'm one of the co-founders of the NORI Carbon Removal Marketplace. Today I have with me Dr. Venki Ramakrishnan, winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry and author of the new book, Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality. Thanks for being here, Venki.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
This topic has come up several times in the past, usually from more philosophical areas about the singularity and should humans live forever. So I'm excited to revisit it now. But I had to ask you, shouldn't you have left the writing of this book to a younger author?
Perhaps, but you know, you have to have time to write it. So, you know, that you write it when you find the time. And the other thing is that I felt things were reaching a moment where tools were becoming more powerful. A lot of science was happening and it was a good time to write it. And also there's a huge amount of hype in the field. And so it was also time to perhaps, you know, take a hard-nosed look at the field and see what it's telling us, what's the promise, and where might we be going.
I'm joking, of course, but one of your arguments in the book about why we might be less exuberant about living forever that is necessary, I've never heard this before, is that many advances in fields are done by younger scholars and that productivity maybe declines with age. It's replaced with the brand value of the scientist rather than their unique intellectual contributions. I'm joking with you about that, but people don't talk about it that way. I think people assume that you get better and better in your field as you go along, particularly for intellectual pursuits. But is that actually not the case?
It's not true. I think, you know, the way to look at it is after somebody has died, you look at their career and you ask, what are they really known for? Why do we remember them? And in the case of scientists, mathematicians, even writers, which I was surprised to find, their best works were done when they were relatively young. In fact, the big breakthroughs scientists or mathematicians make, it's usually done when it's young. Now, that's not true in everything. For example, there are filmmakers, you know, we just saw Martin Scorsese get a nomination for the Academy Award. He's about in his 80s, right? So, and artists we know have, you know, produced great paintings later in life. And the same thing with composers. Many composers and some musicians have done well. But by and large, in many creative fields, our creative ability declines. And that could be, it's not very well understood why. The novelist Kazuo Ishiguro had an idea, which is that maybe as we get older, our short-term memory deteriorates. And in order to be creative, you have to hold a lot of disparate facts in your head and to try and synthesize something new out of them. And maybe that's part of the act of certain kinds of creativity. You have to hold different facts. And maybe that ability declines with age. That's one explanation. Mm. I was in a radio program the other day with Charan Ranganath, who's written a book on memory, why we remember. And he felt that as we get older, we tend to forget the outliers. The outliers get harder to remember, this what he called episodic memory. And so I think for various reasons, some of our, you know, a lot of our creative ability declines. And our ability to learn new things also declines with age. You know, try learning the piano or abstract mathematics when you're older. It's much harder than when you're a child.
friend of mine was telling me about a line in one of the Bob Dylan memoirs where Dylan says that when he was young, he felt like the spotlight of God was pointed right at him, and now it's pointed at someone else. And I've seen him perform a few times, but last time I saw him, it was basically an old guy mumbling in front of a blues band. It was really surreal to see it.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a sort of campiness that if you like Dylan to start, you can listen to his albums from the 80s and past. And these things to like about, but if you weren't already a fan, you probably wouldn't single this person out
exactly,
to listen to.
Exactly. And, you know, in the case of scientists, I'm only half joking, but I say that, you know, people become famous for work that they did when they were younger, and they're typically 20s to 40s. Then they're well known. So what happens is they attract very good people to their lab. And, you know, these people are very smart. And so they carry on the tradition. And of course, the professor often gets the credit, you know, because it's from his or her lab. And so I think this idea of the brand name and influence, it persists in lots of things. And it's even true in the corporate world, I'm afraid. If you look at how old Thomas Edison was when he started his big company, and or you know, the founders of the big companies of today, Google, Apple, etc., they were all very young when they started their companies, and you know, that's when the companies really were creative and took off. Then, of course, they became very powerful, and it's hard to dislodge them. Just like it's hard to dislodge a famous scientist, you know, from big lab. They have a network. They know how to get funding. They have all the labs set up to do, you know, the right sorts of experiments so they can attract good people. So it becomes more of a branding thing. It's not as if they themselves are as creative as they were when they were younger.
Is this something that science and technology will get better at? Will it expand the cognitive abilities further into life for people as they age? Or is this something that's just fundamental about our bodies?
I think there are two aspects to it. One is the biological process of decline. You know, the brain is going to be one of the hardest problems to tackle in terms of aging, partly because our neurons don't regenerate. A very small fraction of our neurons regenerate, unlike liver tissue or skin cells, which regenerate much more frequently. And in fact, many of our neurons persist throughout our lifetime. So the brain, when it declines, is going to be the hardest to reverse. It's also hard to get drugs and other things into the brain because of a blood-brain barrier. And even if you could slow down the cognitive decline, it might be hard to reverse. That's another issue. You know, if you've got slow decline, how do you reverse it? That might be hard. But even if you could do all that, let's say biology advances, you know, tremendously, and we can do that, I think creativity and this sort of novelty of ideas doesn't just come because our brains are young. It also comes because life is young. We're seeing everything for the first time, and everything hits us as novel. We're also more open-minded. We haven't grown into forming our biases and, you know, preconceived notions, and that's as much, I think, a part of creativity as the biological aspect, that the newness of it. And I think that's also why a lot of social movements, social change, often is driven by young people.
I experienced this in the sense that I basically know what art I like at this point. And for me to be swept away by a new artist, it needs to compete with a very established pantheon. And I
exactly.
Guess, yeah. I didn't feel that way when I was younger, and now I'll see new artists and new styles and new things on TikTok or other places, and I feel probably like my parents felt when I was an annoying teenager, that they didn't understand me, and now I'm there. And I don't think any generation really expects to ever be there. Yeah. I think it's always a surprise to everyone as they experience it, but yeah. I'm like less willing I have to force myself a little bit more to try harder to absorb new things when I already have the things that I like. And that's a new sensation for me.
Yeah. And that's why when people say, oh, if we manage to solve the aging problem and we live very long lives, you know, we would do many different things. We would have many different careers. I'm not so sure. I think, you know, a lot of our creative ability and drive comes from the fact that we're seeing things seeing life unfold for the first time. I think that's my view. So I'm a bit skeptical about those rosy scenarios. We may equally live very long, bored lives, you know, or boring lives anyway.
Yeah, there's some, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast previously, but there is an Alan Watts line about how we need death because we lose wonder as we age, and youth is about wonder. And if we just crowded out that space with people who maybe lost the ability to wonder. I mean, there's also an assumption here that maybe this is not set by my biology or not fundamentalism. Maybe I've just become lazy and saltified and ossified in my beliefs over time. And maybe if I knew I was going to live for hundreds of years, my youth might be experienced for decades rather than a much shorter amount of time.
Yeah, very possibly, the evidence is against it.
A lot of the fiction that has been written about immortality seems to be very pessimistic on it too. They very rarely, like Borges, not a fan of immortality.
I'm not either. And I have to tell you, we already live a whole extra life compared to even our ancestors 100 years ago. You know, 150 years ago, life expectancy was about 40. Okay. And now it's more in the 80s. So we've lived a whole extra life. Are we twice as creative as, you know, Mozart or Beethoven or Einstein or people like that? I really don't think so, you know? So I just think, you know, we do more of the same. We live longer lives. We do more of the same, but I'm not sure that we're doing twice as much with our twice as long lives in terms of new things. I mean, really new breakthroughs. We're doing more stuff because we simply are around longer. And so I do think that. And the other point you mentioned about, you know, if you're mortal, you know your life is limited. And so you have that drive to live a full life, to make the most of it. If we live for a very long time, you know, you would lose some of that drive. And even today, you know, there's that famous law that work expands to fill available time, you know. So if you have more time to do the same amount of work, you just use up more time. So, you know, it could be a case of that.
Well, what do you think about the social and environmental costs of living much longer lives? We could become more wise. With more time, maybe we would become less materialistic. Or I could also see us going the other way and becoming more acquisitive. Old people
not really possible to predict. You know, these things are such unknowns. How it would change society if everybody, say, started living to be 200 years. Okay. But I can tell you some rough things that we've learned from the past. So every time there have been major health advances, for example, after the discovery of infection, like cholera was, you know, in London, they figured out that cholera was transmitted through contaminated water. And so then they decoupled the drinking water supply from the sewage supply in London. And that was a big step. And people started living longer, then antibiotics, then vaccines. All of these things made people live longer. And each time there were major advances, the population dramatically increased because people had not yet made that transition to having smaller families. But eventually, in each case, people would start having smaller families and the population would stabilize. But it would stabilize at a higher level. Recently, that's not the case. For example, Japan has increased its life expectancy. It's one of the highest life expectancy countries, you know, in the high 80s. And yet their population has not gone up. In fact, it's declined somewhat. So it's not hard and fast rule that population is going to go up. But if population doesn't go up, a number of things has to happen. Either you have to have even fewer number of children per couple, or you have to space out the generations even more. So, you know, 100 years ago, people were having children by their late teens, early 20s. Now, you know, in Western countries, often it's people have their first child at 30 or even later. And so people would have to space that out, but there's a limit to how much you can space it out because of menopause. Nobody knows how to extend menopause, although that may be something scientists might work on. And so one of those two things has to happen. So if we are to prevent a population explosion, what you would have is a population where the turnover is very, very slow. You know, very few children, people living a very long time, replacement is very slow, or time between generations is very long. And a slowly turning over population means a population where we talked about young people and new ideas and creativity, that sort of social change and regeneration of new ideas, et cetera, would also be, I think, slower. So you'd have a more stagnant society, in my opinion.
Given your confidence in that belief, how do you think we should approach the science of aging, whether it should be reversed or halted? Do you think we should stop infinitely trying to preserve life, or am I misreading you?
I think this quest for immortality is a mirage. You know, we now live twice as long as our ancestors did, and yet people are still fretting about dying and getting old. And I think if we lived 200, then we'd be wondering, hey, wait a minute, why are we only living to 200? Why shouldn't we live to 500? So it's a never-ending, and there's no such thing as real immortality, you know, because we're all made of material stuff. And so I think that chasing that mirage is really a mistake. But there's a different problem which scientists really should address, which is we are getting older as a society, but we're not the fraction of our lives that we're healthy has not gone up. And so we're spending many years now in old age with lots of disabilities, needing care, et cetera. And as the fraction of older people in society increases, this is more and more of a problem, not just for the people themselves, but also for the rest of society. And so one goal is, how can we age more healthily? How can we, you know, attack some of the processes of aging so that they don't cause many of the symptoms of aging? In fact, many diseases of old age are all correlated with age. As we age, we're more likely to get cancer, we're more likely to get diabetes, more likely to get heart disease, more likely to get dementia. We're even more likely to die of COVID. You know, so infectious disease is a problem with old age. So if we can somehow age more healthily so that we're healthier for a much larger fraction of our time, that would be a big bonus to everybody. And it will also allow older people to be independent for longer, to be productive for longer. You know, it would increase their well-being and happiness. So that, I think, is a very worthy goal. The real question is, can you do that without increasing lifespan even further?
That's what I was going to ask. Surely those things are connected, right?
They are connected. And I think this is a very serious problem, because every advance that we've had for heart disease or diabetes has also increased our life expectancy. So the number of years we spend struggling with old age and the problems of old age hasn't actually declined. And that's why you see this explosion of nursing homes and care homes all through most developed countries. So it's not clear that we can stay healthy for a long time but keep our lifespan fixed at, you know, the maximum lifespan of our natural biology, unless we change it, is about 120. And so, you know, are we going to stay healthy until we bump up against that 120 limit and then just suddenly decline and crash? So there's a famous poem called The One Horse Shay by Oliver Wendell Holmes, which describes this horse carriage that's so well constructed that all the parts wear out equally well, you know, hold up equally well. So this farmer is riding along on this 100-year-old carriage, and he's riding along, and 1 second later, he finds himself on the ground surrounded by a heap of dust because the entire carriage has collapsed and disintegrated in front of him. And that's what we're asking of life, that we stay healthy and then suddenly collapse. I'm not sure it can be done. I think it might very well extend our lives even further. And so at the end, we might still face the same problem. There is one thing that suggests some hope, and that is people who study centenarians like Tom Pearls in Boston found that these people who live beyond 105 or 110, they seem to be extremely healthy for nearly all their lives. You know, unlike most people who develop various kinds of ailments, they don't do that. They're healthy. They're often completely independent, and then they have a rapid period of decline, and they sort of, it's as if they hit the biological limit of our species, and they essentially decline and die. So that suggests that maybe it's possible to do it, but how to accomplish that is not entirely clear. And I think maybe more detailed studies on these centenarians, it is providing clues. What's special about them? What's special about their genetics, their physiology, their environment, their lifestyle, all of those things. So I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done there.
We can't just pick up and move to the blue zones. It's not nearly that simple.
Well, that could be a mixture of genetics and, you know, their particular environment. So we don't know.
You know, this might be beyond the scope of your scientific expertise, but sociologically speaking, I am in the beginning of middle age. I'm in my mid-30s, and I find it's such a strange position to be in because my parents are becoming more frail, and I'm realizing that I am the adult in some of these cases, or I even know better, and not like in the teenager sense of, I think you know better, but I think now my judgment in some cases is, and I can see them.
It may very well be. There's no question, you know, it may very well be.
It's really surreal. If you're listening and this hasn't happened to you, this is why I'm talking about archetypes and a broad sociological lens. It will happen to you if you live long enough. Presumably, this will happen.
My dad is 98.
Oh, so
and,
you
know, he still cooks and he does his own laundry and things. So I'm hoping that's like a buffer. When he dies, then I'll know really that I'm, you know, reaching.
You really are the. I also have, so you have that experience, which is surreal, but it's also surreal to look down at a younger generations too and find some of the ideas or culture to be alien and difficult. And maybe it also inspires a sort of conservatism in your side too, where you think some of these newfangled things actually are not improvements and that structures exist for a reason.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Kind of in a spot. What advice do you have for someone who is in that spot? How should we think about aging in our lives?
I think the thing to do is to try and remember what it was like to be young and to challenge conventional wisdom and try to keep an open mind. And as I say, with age, things do get harder, and it does get harder to absorb new information and new ideas. I think it's an effort that pays off. Actually, the more you do it, the more you preserve that ability, I think. So that's, you know, you just have to be open-minded and keep trying.
That's interesting because that seems more of a willpower issue, but then maybe is there some biological basis for your willpower in absorbing new ideas? It sounds like something I could practice. I could just delve into this and try hard rather than just assuming that I'm a conservative by nature. I no longer need new ideas. I have everything figured out. I know how the world works. I should just reject that.
This is ideological. I'm afraid this is way beyond my expertise because I'm not a neurobiologist or a psychologist. But I do think as we decline cognitively, you know, when we find tasks more difficult, we tend to avoid them. You know, that's what people do with, you know, at whatever age. If things are too difficult, you tend to avoid it. And so I think it may be something to do with that, but I couldn't say really. But I know exactly the phenomenon you're talking about because we all experience that. And I'm about 3 decades further along. You know, I'm 71, so.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess I'll have to think more about that. And it's probably unfair to put that on you to solve such a huge question for me.
No, which I don't think many of these things don't have an obvious solution and may not for decades. So, but it doesn't make them less interesting. And I think they are things that we need to think about.
I think people think about them at some level pretty often. I think it structures a lot of their everyday experience. And I think subconsciously they're thinking about how they fit into the social order around them. And age is a big component of that.
Yeah.
I have another kind of big one for you. This might be beyond your scope, and it's okay to be actually personal or anecdotal.
I wanted to talk about, you know, older people in the community. And I think one thing that we do is we tend to sequester older people away from the rest of society. You know, they're in retirement communities or nursing homes. And people, you know, used to die in their, surrounded by their family usually in the old days. Now they die in hospitals. And so even death has been kind of outsourced to some, you know, location. And I think that's not a great thing for either the young or the old. I think integrating all generations in society, it really helps everybody. It teaches the young what it's like to be old. It teaches them what's ahead. The older people can be role models, and older people can then still feel part of society, contribute their knowledge and advice and take part in society. So that's something that as we age as a society, we need to think about how to integrate generations much better.
And I think hiding those unpleasant parts of life, and I'll know that has served us very well. It certainly makes things easier in the short term. It's very unpleasant to watch a loved one die or nearly die, but having that dealt with professionals behind curtains, I don't know that prepares you for your own death or...
No, it's not at all. It's not a good thing, I think.
How do you feel about personally dying?
Personally?
Yeah, I guess it's very an impersonal way to die. I mean, you as an individual ceasing to exist in the corporeal form.
The reality is none of us wants to die, but we have evolved so that we don't brood about it. You know, if we started brooding about death all the time, it would just be morbid. Literally, it would be morbid. And so I think we have evolved to carry on as if we're immortal. So, you know, I'm planning things a year and a half out, you know, what I'm going to do in October of 2025. And I'm assuming I'm going to be there. And that just keeps on going. So it's not like I said, oh, well, you know, I have a 50% chance of survival up to 2030 or something. And so I'm not going to bother thinking about life beyond that. So I think we're programmed not to think about death. We're programmed to bury it. Of course, it's still there, though. We can never escape it, that feeling of mortality. I think none of us really wants to die. We need to become, of course, we all realize we have to be philosophical. We know we're going to die. We have to deal with it. But there's the old joke about who would want to live to be 100? And the answer is someone who's 99. And so I think that shows that if there were interventions, if somebody gave you a pill which said, this pill will give you 10 extra years of healthy life. You know, most of us would take that pill. And I take life extension pills. I take statins for cholesterol. I take blood pressure medication. All of those are so that I don't die sooner than expected of a stroke or heart attack. And so in a way that they're basically life extension medicines, which help me live healthier and longer. So I think that's that we have a deep will to live, partly because it's not the death we fear. It's not being dead that we fear. It's not existing. That's what we fear. And our identity is so interwoven with our existence as a living creature that I just don't think we can escape that.
Does non-existence frighten you?
It doesn't frighten me. I haven't thought much about it. It doesn't frighten me, but I enjoy life. I like my family and friends, and I like, you know, my hobbies, my work. So, you know, I wouldn't want to leave it yet. And so that's how it is. But I think people often reach a stage, especially when they're very old or if they're suffering and, you know, some terminal disease that's really causing them a lot of suffering. And at that point, they're willing to let go. But I think each individual has to make that decision themselves.
Something theological I've thought about for a very long time, that Christianity has this idea that at the second coming, humans will be resurrected in body and soul. They will be reincorporated in physical form. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a South Asianist scholar, and he was saying this is so weird because many Eastern religions, specifically Hinduism, that he had studied, the goal is to escape this too, and Buddhism too. The goal is to no longer be reincarnated back into a body. This is something to be avoided. And if you can ideally ascend out of this plane, that's as good as it gets. And it's amazing that we, like the difference in revenue, I'm hesitant to do too strong of an East-West comparison there, but I always found that to be really striking because I feel a lot of anxiety about what happens after I die, what it means, do I return to a state of non-identity, non-personal form, do I exist at all? And he's like, whatever, you blend back in, and that's the goal anyways. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's true. It's not just Christianity. It's all the Abrahamic religions. So Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all believe in a bodily resurrection. And it's why traditionally those religions insisted on burial, and cremation was considered a bad thing traditionally. And so that's one view. And then, of course, Hindus believe that, well, the body might decay, but you have this eternal soul that can flit from one body, even from one species to another. And Egyptians had a combination. They believed in an immortal soul, but they also believed that the body itself would get resurrected. And that's why they had these pharaohs all mummified and entombed in these fancy tombs. So I think these are all ways of looking at death as not final, but a transition to something else, you know, either through an immortal soul or even through your body. But there are ways of saying death is not an end point, but it's a transition to something else. And that's reflected in our language as well. We very often will hesitate to say, oh, my mother died. You know, you say, my mother passed on, or my mother passed, or my mother departed, as if, you know, she's gone to some other state and she's still around, but in a different state. So I think that reflects our views about death and really how much we don't like this idea of non-existence that we talked about.
All of this discussion is making it difficult for me to pull out a core thesis here about ethically what we should expect with death or living longer, except it seems to me that because there are physical limits, or at least there seem to be now, it's almost a little bit of a moot point for you because you don't think we're going to be able to upload ourselves into some digital infrastructure. That's probably not going to happen. Our physical bodies are probably not going to persist.
I'm extremely skeptical about all these efforts to preserve our current state indefinitely. For example, there's this whole field of cryonics where people freeze bodies and think that, oh, well, we don't know how to resurrect them now, but in 200 years, science will have advanced enough that they'll figure out how to thaw these bodies and also cure whatever it was that they died of so that they'll reemerge as healthy individuals with their minds and memories and everything intact. There's no evidence that this can happen. It comes from the fact that we can freeze small things like cells. You know, people freeze, you can freeze your cells. People routinely freeze fertilized embryos or eggs or sperm for future use. Often people, young people who are going through chemotherapy will freeze their eggs or freeze their sperm so that they can have babies later. So that happens. And people have frozen things as big as worms. And those worms can be thawed and live. But even a small animal like a mouse, nobody's shown that you can freeze a mouse and then thaw it and it'll function just fine. And then people say, well, okay, well, we don't need to do that. We just need to make sure that the neuronal connections are preserved. And then we can extract from those connections essentially their mind and dump it into a computer. And then, you know, the computer will then have all of our memories and feelings and consciousness and everything about us. It confuses these neuronal connections, et cetera, with the state of the brain. The state of the brain depends on what were those neurons like at the moment of death. And also it assumes that you're capturing a snapshot right before the person died. But in fact, what you have to do is you have to inject all this embalming fluid in somebody and then freeze it. It all takes time. During that time, the whole thing is deteriorating. Mm. And I think of it as saying that, oh, if you have a roadmap of the United States at any given point, you're going to know exactly what the state of the country was. Well, no, you'll know what the big cities were where people tended to live because you'll see a big hub of roads going in and out and you'll see what the connections are. So you'll learn a lot about the country, but you won't be able to recreate the state of the United States from a roadmap of the United States. So I think this is a little bit of, it's a lot of hype there. And I'm very skeptical about those.
Even if it did work, I would be very worried about the governance of digital personhood. I don't know that I would want to be immortal in a machine that humans controlled.
Yes.
That's terrifying.
Exactly. And also, what these people who are mostly not neurobiologists, most neurobiologists paid no credence to these ideas, is that much of our existence and our conscious feeling is driven by interaction with the rest of our body. For example, hormones often drive and determine our feelings. We get pleasure from food. We get even pleasure from exercise, from a good walk, from social company. A lot of that is due to chemical interactions between the brain and the rest of the body. So the brain doesn't exist in isolation. And it's not clear that all of that can be reduced to some sort of circuitry so that you could provide, you know, appropriate electrical signals that would simulate all the stuff. Nobody knows how to do any of that. And right now, this is all in the realm of science fiction. And of course, people will say, well, a lot of science fiction, a lot of things that are true today, like going to the moon and back and all sorts of space travel, all started off as science fiction, and yet we've done it. And my reply to that is, if you look at all these ideas that are proposed, you know, a small fraction of them come true. And the vast majority of these ideas are basically crackpot ideas that never actually came to fruition. So just the fact that, you know, once in a while, some idea happens to work out and be prophetic, doesn't mean that most of these ideas are not wacky.
Are we making progress on the various protein-based disorders that are afflicting people? I don't even know how you solved that one. That one really hurts my brain.
I think we are, in the sense we can figure out how to improve, for example, many of the metabolic pathways that are triggered by restricting our calories, and which in animals has shown to improve symptoms of old age and actually even make us live longer. Many of those pathways do directly affect the whole problem of misfolded proteins and accumulation of bad proteins. For example, the cell's recycling mechanism, where badly formed proteins are shunted away for degradation, that's stimulated when we restrict calories, or when we stimulate those when we inhibit those pathways that are inhibited by caloric restriction. So that's why, for example, certain drugs like rapamycin, which mimics caloric restriction in some ways, not entirely, but some aspects of caloric restriction. That's why rapamycin seems to have beneficial effects in animals. And of course, rapamycin is also an immunosuppressant, but in your hometown of Seattle, there's a very famous scientist at UW who's testing rapamycin in dogs, Matt Kaeberlein. And the idea of using dogs is very interesting to me because, you know, laboratory animals are held in isolated, sterile cages. So they're not mimicking the natural world and the natural risks of what might happen with long-term use of rapamycin. But dogs are free to wander around, and they're as diverse as their owners. You know, they live in different houses, different parts of the country, probably fed different diets, totally different environments. So I think that study might tell us quite a lot interesting about how effective is rapamycin and how safe is it to use. And if we can establish that in dogs, then that's a first step to trying to do trials in humans.
Is there anything you wanted to speak about before we start wrapping up?
No, I think aging is at a stage where there's a lot of biological research going on, but there's also a lot of money in aging because we're aging as a society. A lot of these billionaires are aging and they don't like the idea, so they're funding aging research. And so there's a lot of action going on, and associated with that, there's a lot of hype. But behind the hype, there's also some real solid science. So I wouldn't be surprised if we at least started to alleviate some of the distressing effects of aging by studying biology. Now, I always say that currently there's nothing better available on the market that's been tested in humans than diet, exercise, and sleep. You know, if you eat moderately and eat a healthy diet, get regular exercise, and make sure you get adequate sleep, that's better than any medication out there that's actually been shown to work. But of course, I tried that with my blood pressure, and I tried that with my cholesterol for years. And eventually, you know, I had to resort to blood pressure medication, and I had to resort to statin. So I think part of the goal of what I call the bona fide aging research community, is to come up with things that actually help you better beyond what you can do with these natural interventions, and really tackle some of the more distressing aspects of aging, so to allow us to live healthier. So I think that's the goal. And if they succeed, I think we'll all thank them for it in our old age. And this quest for immortality and all this stuff about downloading your brain and things like that, I think that's all science fiction. And my view is, we're a long way from that, if ever.
I think you're just jealous that you don't have your own blood boy.
Yes, that's true. I didn't talk about blood transfusions where people, and this is actually, this is a case where this real biology, but it was so hyped and misused right away. And this is where they did experiments where they connected, say, rats, a young rat with an old rat. And they found that the blood from the young rat actually improved the symptoms of old age in the old rat. The old rat became healthier, its muscles tone became better, skin tone became better, etc. And contrary-wise, it appeared that the old blood also harmed the young rat. So there are things in old blood that were not so great for the young rat. So scientists are busy trying to identify. Blood has hundreds of factors which do all sorts of things. And some of them might stimulate growth. Some of them might inhibit processes that are detrimental. So scientists are busy trying to isolate these factors and trying to understand how they act, trying to see what is it about young blood that has these beneficial effects. Of course, that's a long, ongoing process, but the market didn't wait for that. So suddenly there were these companies set up that offered to give you young blood as a transfusion and charging, an arm and a leg for it. And I think this is a case where there were no clinical trials, no real evidence of that it would, how much it would improve your life and what it would do. They just took this animal data and immediately started charging people for it. And I think it's exploiting people's fear of getting old and dying. And that's really what these guys are doing.
Do you have any thoughts on the environmental, ecological, or climate impacts of aging? Have you thought much about that connection? I think there's clearly some indirect ways that people can draw some conclusions from what we're talking about, but I'm wondering if you personally thought about it.
I did think about it, while I was thinking about the social consequences of people living longer. And I think if we're not careful and the population goes up, so we have this choice between a very society with a very slow turnover and a society that turns over just as fast, but then the population will keep going, so that regenerates. Each new generation happens every 20 or 30 years, but each generation lives much longer. Then you'll start accumulating people, and then the population will go up. And that, of course, we're already stressing the Earth's resources, and so it's not clear. Of course, what I call the techno-optimists say population has nothing to do with it. We're going to solve it all technologically. We're going to come up with green solutions for energy and better ways of living and less impactful ways, and we'll all be fine, and it has nothing to do with population. I'm not sure they're right. I think it will actually stress our resources if we consume just as much and there's simply more of us. But the thing that's unknown is how it would change our behavior if we live very long. Would we become more responsible because we're on Earth a longer time and we need to live with the consequences? And so we need to live with the consequences if there's climate change. And so we might have to become more responsible. So there are different views. I don't think there's a fixed answer to your question. I think, though, it's not something that you can predict very easily.
thought maybe if humans lived at civilizational scales, maybe they would see a vested interest in greater permanence. But I'm not actually, I mean, that's just an idea. I have no idea if that would actually
help. Yeah, no, that, I have heard that said, but there's no evidence for it one way or another. You know, that's the problem.
Yeah, people live the better part of a century. Have they gotten better at thinking longer term? Like, I guess in some ways they have at least more practice at it, but maybe not at the skills we would need to solve for.
I'm not sure. I mean, we're living longer now, and we're producing more and more throwaway material, throwaway goods, things that don't last very long. I'm not sure that we're actually, you know, behaving in a more thoughtful way because we're living longer. I just don't think that's true.
Are you?
But of course, it's an unknowable question.
Yeah, but shouldn't old age connote some amount of wisdom? I thought that was part of the trade-off.
It does. I think my feeling, you know, my children are in their 40s or early 50s. And at this point, I think they're just as wise as I am. I don't think that I have any more wisdom than they do. I think young people, if you're very young, you lack wisdom, and insurance rates will reflect that. You know, if you're a teenage driver, insurance companies know you're rash, you're impulsive, you don't have that wisdom. But I think once you reach your mid 30s or certainly 40, I think you've accumulated the wisdom, all the wisdom you're going to have. You might accumulate more experience and knowledge as you get older, and that could help you.
But yeah, maybe not in sufficient quantities to avoid all the problems that we have now. We've just created new problems, bigger problems.
Yeah.
Banky, thank you for being here. Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality. You have a Bill Bryson blurb up top. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of important ideas in there. Thanks for catching me up on the science. I also really appreciate when people are not boosters nor just diehard critics, but are trying to follow the science and explain it. That's valuable work.
Yeah, that is what I've tried, is to try and just be objective and neither poo-poo the whole thing nor hype it. You know, try to find that balance.
Yeah, make everyone dislike you because you're disappointing everyone. That's on no allegiances to any particular ideological group.
But I think it's very important for the public to understand the biology, because understanding the biology of why we die is actually a guide to how we live or how to live, because it allows you to take action and do the things that will improve your life because there are good reasons for it. You know, we talked about the, you know, diet, exercise, and sleep. Biology explains why those things work. And so once we know why they're effective, it's a motivating factor to implement that in our lives. And it also allows us to see through things which couldn't possibly be true given what we know about biology. So I think it is, apart from curiosity, all of us, of course, are curious about why is it we age? Why do tortoises live 200 years and we live 100 years at the most, and butterflies live for weeks. So why is there this huge variation in lifespan? What is it that causes aging? So apart from all the curiosity, it's also a practical guide to implementing the things that will actually give you a healthier life, rather than giving you a recipe of doing this, that, and the other without really an explanation for why those things would work.
I think that's a very good way to sum it up. And thank you so much for being here. I really enjoyed chatting with you, and see you again sometime.
Thank you so much for listening. If you could please subscribe and give us a great rating and review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on Spotify, that'd be much appreciated. It helps us get our content out to more people. You can sign up for our newsletter at nori.com, follow us on social media, and we will catch you next time.